in a space bearing the words the United Nations, in a process we are deeply committed to as the eyes, ears and voices of our people fighting for justice. The body that was created after the horrors of the Second World War with a promise of never again. A promise that made it illegal to target civilians. A promise that it made it illegal to use food, water, medicine as a weapon of war. A promise of human rights. A promise that all people would be able to live with dignity, free from occupation and oppression. And for these last 2 months, we have witnessed not just the Palestinian people starved, trapped, cut off from the world, bombed and killed, their screams echoing throughout the night with no hope of rescue. As every morning, we wait desperately for that message that our friends and our colleagues are still alive. But whilst watching the international community stand in silence, and again, not just for these last two months, but for 15 years of an illegal blockade, for 50 years of an occupation and apartheid, and 100 years of ethnic cleansing and settler colonialism. We watched an international community that has been actively complicit in war crimes, in crimes against humanity, where the genocidal intent isn't even bothered to be hidden anymore. And still, of course, that's not enough. We've seen hospitals, schools bombed. We've seen medics, journalists, and even UN staff killed. 18,000 people, human rights and humanitarian law, it's lying in shreds. And some ask us, why do we care about the Palestinians? Why do climate justice groups mobilize in their millions from Pakistan to the Philippines, from Belgium to Brazil, from South Africa to Sweden? Why is it that people from all around the world, black, white, brown, Jew, Muslim, Christian, are taken to the streets? It's because we have seen the masks that have slipped. We have seen how the Palestinians are not even viewed as human beings. And in the faces of the Palestinians, for black, brown and indigenous people, we see our past, our present and our future, of lives deemed less valuable than others, of an arc of 500 years of colonialism and racialized capitalism, of sacrificed people and of sacrificed land, of the powerful profiting from oppression, but then saying they don't have any money for climate finance, but billions for bombs and bullets against the people. And we say to those powerful countries who put words of human rights into text over there that no amount of empty words will ever erase your complicity. You not only wrote the blank check, you enabled this. You own this. You own this as much as those who are dropping the bombs on the terrified people of Palestine. So here today, we, the peoples of the world, say to the Palestinian people, the international community over there may have forgotten you, but you are not alone. You will never be alone, because we are all Palestinians. Ceasefire now, end settler colonialism, end apartheid, end occupation, free Palestine.
We're going to close this moment by respecting the names, the identities, the children, the women, the mothers, the fathers, the journalists have been murdered. We are going to read some of those names.
Isa Ahmed, Isa Nashar, 8 years old. Zaid Sabri Musleh Radi, 8 years old. Faiz Shadi Faiz Al-Dakka, 8 years old.
Mena Hisam Mahmoud Abu Ayyada, 14 years old. Mahmoud Muhammad Fathi Al-Sha'ir, 14 years old.
Amjad Khalid Kamal Raswan, 3 years old. Salma Muhammad Al-Khalil Abu Launa, 2 years old.
Voices from a protest Sunday inside the UN Climate Summit here in Dubai, showing solidarity with the Palestinian people, calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. The first voice in this last segment was Charbonne Cornell of the Muskegee Nation here in the United States. And the last speech you heard was our guest right now, Asad Rahman. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. The summit opening Thursday with delegates agreeing to adopt a new loss and damage fund to help poorer nations deal with the disproportionate impact of the climate crisis. Initial funding starts at something like $429 million, just a fraction of what's needed to address the annual cost of climate catastrophes. Governments from the Global South and climate activists welcomed the fund, but underscored its deficiencies. The themes here at COP28 today are finance, trade, gender equality, and accountability. Sunday, the focus was health. The disease that is generated by the pathogens, the challenges to global health that are generated by climate change. We're joined now by Asad Rahman, the executive director of War and Want, lead spokesperson for the Climate Justice Coalition that held this unusual protest. It's not unusual for the world, Asad, and I know from where you come from in London, there have been massive protests, as there have been in the United States, against Israel's assault on Gaza. But here, the rules are very strict. We did not once hear Israel, a country, named. Talk about why.
Well, first of all, you're right. It's a unique protest. And we have to say it's a unique protest also in Dubai generally. There are no protests allowed, and there have been no protests on Palestine allowed. In fact, the last protest on Palestine was back in 2008. This is a UN body, and the UN body has certain rules. Those include you can't name or shame a country. You can't use somebody's flag, which are usually rules that, of course, we all abide by. But this year, there's been even added pressure. And this is largely because we are talking about Israel and we're talking about Palestine, where very, very powerful countries, in fact, they're the same powerful countries who are blocking the action we need on climate change, have been pressuring that there should not be a voice raised on Palestine. In fact, we've been explicitly told, why is Palestine being raised in this climate space? This is inappropriate for us to be raising the issue of Palestine, where, of course, this is the most appropriate place because we're talking about the rights of people and solidarity with people and our visions, not just of the past, the present, and, as I said, of the future.
And, I mean, this intersectionality we saw last year in Sharm el-Sheikh, right, with the climate justice advocates standing together with Egyptian human rights activists, demanding people be released from prison, et cetera, saying that you can't talk about justice and climate separately.
Absolutely. We held our protests actually on the day that this place talked about human rights. And so you had many countries writing words in the drafts and preambles about the importance of human rights. And yet when we were raising human rights, and when we were saying that there can be no climate justice without human rights, we were being told that that was unacceptable, inappropriate. And so it's been a real challenge, and particularly for many Palestinians who are unable to attend and have been unwilling to attend for a whole number of reasons. They've looked to us as global civil society to use this moment, because we are, as we meet here, as your correspondent set was talking from Gaza, the bombs are dropping, people are dying, and the international community is unwilling to act. And we know we could stop this bombing by some very powerful countries, particularly the US, saying no, ceasefire now.
It's interesting that the former U.S. presidential candidate, former U.S. senator, the U.S. climate envoy here, drove by the protest as it was taking place. That was John Kerry.
Indeed, absolutely. And you know, last year, I mean, it's interesting, the U.S. delegates last year walked out of one of the plenary rooms when the Russian representative spoke, in their expression of solidarity on Ukraine. But yet we are told speaking up and showing solidarity with the Palestinian people in the face of an ethnic cleansing, ongoing, clearly genocidal intent. And we're seeing now what's happening with more and more Palestinians pushed closer and closer to the Rafah border, starved of food, water, medicine, and inevitable, nowhere to go. And what the consequences of that is likely to be is going to be horrendous. And so this is the moment we have to speak out.
Inside the summit, the issue of Israel's assault on Gaza was raised by Cyril Ramaphosa of South Africa, by Gustavo Petro of Colombia, and other world leaders.
Absolutely. And world leaders were allowed to speak and raised it. And we were very welcome and we're glad that they did. But we as civil society have had very, very many challenging conversations to be even able to say the word ceasefire. We were not allowed to talk about apartheid. We're not allowed to say the word settler colonialism. You may have noticed that those banners had certain other variations of words on them. And this is because our own language was being policed. And we think that that's totally inappropriate. It's not for the UN to decide. In fact, we are using language that the United Nations itself uses, its own human rights experts use, its own UN agencies are saying there is a system of apartheid. Ethnic cleansing is taking place.
Well, I want to go to someone who was allowed to speak, and that is Gustavo Petro, the president of Colombia. This was what he said when he addressed the UN climate summit here in Dubai.
Los invito a que imaginemos una fusión.
I invite you to think about a fusion, a combination of events, the climate crisis and the genocide of the Palestinian people. Are these events disconnected, is my question, or are we seeing here a mirror of what is going to happen in the future? The genocides and the barbaric acts unleashed against the Palestinian people is what awaits those who are fleeing south because of the climate crisis. Most victims of climate change, which will be counted in the billions, will be in those countries that do not emit CO2 or emit very little. Without the transfer of wealth from the north to the south, the climate victims will increasingly have less drinking water in their homes, and they will have to migrate north, where the melting glaciers will make it possible for people to have drinking water. The exodus will be in the billions.
El éxodo será respondido con muchísima violencia.
There will be pushback against the exodus, with violence, with barbaric acts committed. This is what is happening in Gaza. This is a rehearsal for the future. Why have the major carbon-consuming nations made it possible for the systemic killing of thousands of children in Gaza, is my question. Because if they do not kill them, they will invade their country to prevent them from consuming their carbon. We can therefore see what the future will look like. There will be a shrinking of democracy and unleashed barbaric acts against our peoples, those of us who do not emit CO2. Those of us who are poor.
That's the Colombian president, Gustavo Petro, speaking here at the UN Climate Summit in the United Arab Emirates in Dubai. Asad Rehman, so let's talk about this climate summit. If you can talk about issues of loss and damage, and just remember for a global audience, people don't even know what loss and damage means. There's a lot of jargon that keeps people out of understanding what's taking place.
Absolutely. So we started this climate summit with a warning that we're currently headed at least to 2.9 degree warming. And if we think about the violence and the impacts that happen in the United States, all over the world, that's all happening at just over 1 degree warming. So 2.9 is going to be devastating. Some estimate we're closer to heading towards 4 degrees if all the new fossil fuel expansion, particularly by countries like the US, UK and the European Union, comes on stream. The big question here is basically, will rich countries live up to their responsibility to act? And instead, they've been pushing that action onto other countries. Now, those damages that are happening, and those are economic and social, and just to put into context, if we remember the floods in Pakistan that happened last year, they were cost Pakistan $35 billion. That was the damage. And developing countries have been saying for a long time to rich countries, you've caused this problem. Are you going to help us deal with its impacts? And rich developed countries have been saying, no, we don't. But finally here, we got a fund. But then the big question came, who's going to put money into it? And developed countries said, we are not going to be liable. In fact, the United States put a paltry $17 million into that fund. The very next day announced billions in money for missiles and bombs to Israel and to Ukraine. So it shows you the disparity of what's going on. And this has been a long-standing issue. The second thing and big thing that's happening here is what they call a global stocktake. And this is really the idea of you see how far we've come in progress, and then you decide how much more do we need to do. And again, rich countries have come there and said, forget what's happened in the past. We might not have acted in the past. Forget all of that, that we're responsible for all that. Now we just have to look towards the future. And developing countries are saying, but hold on, the majority of what's happened now is because of your past, because you've polluted so much. You have to take responsibility. And that flows into the conversations about finance. And of course, and interestingly, and what a lot of commentators and a lot of civil society are looking at, is a new conversation happening here, which is called the Just Transition Work Pathway. In the United States, we've seen the IRA, the idea of transitioning the economy, and there's calls for that to be happening at a global level. But the US, the UK, and the European Union are saying, we are going to take responsibility for our transition in the North, but we're not going to take responsibility in supporting you in the Global South. And lots of Global South countries saying, but without your support, without the technology, without the finance, we are not going to be able to transition.
And what do you say to Sultan Al-Jaber, who is the president of the COP, also the president of ADNOC, that's the Abu Dhabi National Oil Corporation, who, in a conversation with Mary Robinson, former president of Ireland, said that sustainable development, a phase-out of fossil fuels, would not allow sustainable development unless you want to take the world back into caves. He tried to defend his comments today in his press conference, saying he believes in science.
Well, and it's not just him. I mean, the fact that we have had leaders of rich countries coming here and saying we believe in the science, but expanding fossil fuels at home shows that what we need is a equitable phase out of fossil fuels. But we also need, you know, at the same time, a recognition that for developing countries, many, many poor countries, they are still dealing with the fact that people don't have energy. And so energy poverty and energy access is needed. And the only way we can be both deal with the fossil fuel issue and deal with the question of poverty is to connect both and to say we need an equitable phase out, but we also need a just transition.
This is the largest UN climate summit ever, held in a country that does not allow protests. The significance of this, we have just 30 seconds.
Well, it's hugely problematic because, of course, our role as civil society is the eyes, ears and voice of people, is to be able to put pressure not only in the negotiating rooms, but on the outside. And one of that is by our power and mobilizing. When you take away one of our key tools, you minimize our ability to be able to shape these negotiations and deliver the impact that we need.
We want to thank you so much, Asad Rehman, Executive Director of War on Want, lead spokesperson for the Climate Justice Coalition. Next, for the first time in 9 years, a representative from Human Rights Watch has been allowed access to the United Arab Emirates. We'll speak to her back in a minute. should fall from grace with God by the Pogues. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. This year marks the first time in 9 years that Human Rights Watch has been allowed access to the United Arab Emirates. We're turning now to look at conditions here in the UAE, the climate crisis, as well as human rights. Human Rights Watch is out with a new report headlined, "You Can Smell Petrol in the Air. UAE Fossil Fuels Feed Toxic Pollution." Its earlier report, titled, "Heat at COP28 Highlights Risks to Migrant Workers." For more, we're joined by Joey Shea, researcher in the Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch, investigating human rights abuses in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. She, along with four colleagues, has been allowed in for the first time in 9 years to UAE. Joey, thank you for joining us. Talk about the significance of what you have found in one report after another that you're putting out now.
Yeah, and it's great to be here, and it's great to be here in Dubai. As you said, this is the first time that Human Rights Watch has been able to access the UAE in 9 years. Over the past decade, UAE authorities have engaged on a sustained assault against basic rights and freedoms. There is no independent civil society in this country. Civil society organizations have been banned, and there has been a sustained targeting of human rights defenders, activists, judges, lawyers, regular Emirati citizens who dare speak out about the human rights abuses taking place. One of the cases that we have been following very closely is the case of Ahmed Mansour, who is a current member of Human Rights Watch's advisory committee, and he has been imprisoned in an isolation cell since March 2017. He was arrested and detained and sentenced to 10 years in prison in 2018 based purely on tweets that related to documentation of violations in the UAE, and as well as private WhatsApp messages sent from Ahmed Mansour to groups like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. So it's very striking that HRW is here today. We're happy to be here. We want to continue to engage, but the rights crisis in this country is very concerning.
And it's not only Ahmed Mansour, of course, in prison. If you can talk about other mass trials of people who simply sign petitions.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have been following this case called the UAE 94 case for the past 10 years. In 2011, a group of academics, lawyers, drafted a very politely worded petition calling for greater participation in governance in the UAE. For that petition, starting in 2012, there was a months-long crackdown on those individuals, and they were arbitrarily arrested, 94 of them, which is where the UAE 94 case comes from. In 2013, after a trial marred with due process violations that did not meet the standards for a fair trial, HRW was there at the time and documented these violations, 69 of these defendants were sentenced to between 5 and 10 years imprisonment. Now, many of those defendants have actually been up for release, even though they should not have spent a single day in prison. They are still being held beyond their release date on these bogus counterterrorism charges, which effectively allows UAE authorities to keep individuals imprisoned indefinitely.
Joey, can you talk about migrant workers? People may be surprised to understand that 88% of the population of United Arab Emirates are migrant workers. 88%. What are the conditions that they work under?
Horrendous. So migrant workers in the UAE work under what is called the kafala or sponsorship system, which ties their legal status in this country to their employers. And this makes them incredibly vulnerable to labor-related violations. So exorbitant recruitment fees, wage theft, and also extreme heat-related health risks. Where we are today in Dubai Expo City, where COP28 is being held, was built by migrant workers. And in the summer months in the UAE, the temperatures come up to 100 degrees Fahrenheit, completely, you know, extreme heat. And yet these workers are forced to labor, even in these conditions of extreme heat. And there are woefully inadequate protections in place in this country.
Have there been some changes in dealing with their working conditions that they not be required to work when it is so hot out?
Yeah, so there have been some reform. So the UAE now prohibits explicitly forced labor. And as well, they have brought in what is called a midday work ban, which spans from June until September and does not allow work between the hours of noon and 3 p.m. However, if you've ever been to Dubai in August, extreme heat goes beyond just noon and 3 p.m. And yet these workers are forced to labor in these conditions. As well, the government doesn't enforce these regulations across the board. And we've documented time and time again health risks from migrant workers who've been forced to work in these conditions.
And talk about where these migrant workers are from.
So this is what's so important for COP28. These migrant workers come from countries on the front lines of the climate crisis. They are from Nepal. They are from Bangladesh. And the UAE is externalizing its climate risks because these workers are on the front lines of this crisis, of the climate crisis. Their families back home are subject to the extreme weather events. So, for example, their homes are being destroyed. And the migrant workers here are unable to send remittances back because they're subject to this abusive kafala system. So
we're talking about Nepal, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Philippines.
Yes, absolutely. The families back at home are under severe financial stress from the climate crisis, and the workers here are unable to provide that financial support because they are subject to the abusive kafala system, which takes their wages, and they also have health impacts from working in extreme heat, and there's no compensation from the UAE government or from their employers to help them deal with these health
impacts. How did they get here?
They're subject to this kafala system, so they're brought in by companies, and these companies often charge them exorbitant recruitment fees. So already when they arrive here, they are subject, in many cases, subject to extreme debt that's very difficult to get out of.
Joey Shea, if you can talk about your mass surveillance report.
Yeah, absolutely. So from the moment COP28 participants landed in Dubai, they were subject to intense mass surveillance from the Emirati government. So in Dubai alone, there are 300,000 cameras around in public spaces. As well, where we are in Dubai Expo City, there are thousands of cameras conducting mass surveillance. In addition to mass surveillance, the UAE government has been documented using targeted digital surveillance. So, for example, Ahmed Mansour, who we just spoke about, he was an early recipient of NSO's notorious spyware, Pegasus spyware, and the WhatsApp messages that were used to incriminate him in his case, which with organizations such as Human Rights Watch, were taken from his phone through the use of Pegasus.
And what are people doing about this? I know at the airport, we were handed back with our passports a 5G SIM card.
Yeah. I hope you didn't put that SIM card in your phone. And it has an absolute chilling effect on COP28 participants who see the cameras, who understand that there's mass surveillance. It's very difficult, impossible to have private conversations here, especially if you're a climate activist trying to mobilize against fossil fuels.
Tell us what would happen if you put those 5G SIM cards in your phone.
It's very likely that you would be tracked, of course, and your phone may be infected with spyware that we don't even know exists.
We just have 20 seconds. How does it feel to be back here in the UAE, your organization, Human Rights Watch?
It feels very good, but we also have seen the intense deterioration in the human rights situation in this country over the past 10 years. We want to be able to have access, but unfortunately, we're not sure that will be the case beyond the special rules set out by the UN just for COP28.
Joey Shea, we want to thank you for being with us, researcher in the Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. We're going to link to all of your reports. Heat at COP28 highlights risk to migrant workers, and you can smell petrol in the air. And it's very good to know that you are back here telling us what's happening here. Happy belated birthday to Emily Gosselin. I'm Amy Goodman from Dubai.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of CanadaLand, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.